Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Handling the Heat, the podcast by RestaurantEquipment.biz, where we dive into the real stories behind the people powering the food service industry. Today, we're joined by Abe Ng, the founder and CEO of Sushi Maki, a Miami-based sushi brand that's redefined what it means to scale quality, approachable sushi across restaurants, universities, hotels, and even Whole Foods. We talk about Abe's early days growing up in a Chinese-American restaurant, what it was like walking away from a career in finance to launch a wrap concept that didn't quite stick, and how that failure led the groundwork for Sushi Maki's success. Abe shares what it takes to build operational excellence, win marquee partnerships, and keep sushi fresh, in every sense of the word, at scale. Stay tuned if you're interested in restaurant growth, wholesale logistics, or what it takes to launch a concept and scale it sustainably. Abe, thank you so much for joining us on Handling the Heat. Super excited to chat with you about your experience in the restaurant space.
Well, hey, delighted to be here, Mr. Sherman.
Cool. Abe, what's something you've eaten recently that you've really enjoyed? Something we ask every guest on the show.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. Well, I was in New York City last weekend, and we went back to an old favorite. And there's so many awesome steakhouses, but just going back to Peter Luger after so many years. I think one of my first times was with your dad, Big Neil, enjoying Peter Luger's. And, you know, you can get amazing steak at so many spots, but just the service, the onion, the tomato, you know, was really special. I forgot how much I enjoyed it. So that was special. And kind of on that same trip, just the amount of matcha that's available, just going and trying different kind of permutations of matcha and cold frothy drinks was a lot of fun too.
Yeah, especially in the New York heat that we've had. I'm actually based in New York City, so I'm smack dab in the middle of the matcha renaissance here. And we actually had a matcha operator join us for our first episode, opened up a couple matcha shops in Austin, Texas. But I think honestly, matcha is taking a similar journey as sushi, you know, in terms of its popularity, starting obviously in Japan and then, you know, building up pretty crazy into almost like a frenzy here in the States. But let's take it back a little bit earlier, Abe, before we get into the sushi experience. So I know you started your working experience in the family restaurant business. So can you talk to me a little bit about, you know, your initial experience working with family, working in restaurants, and kind of how that kicked you off on your journey?
So I say that the restaurant sector has been in my blood even before I was born. Most people don't know this, but my mom's family had a little bit of a cafe bakery in Hong Kong where they had baked goods and coffees and milk teas. So my mom grew up in and around, you know, that environment. And on my wife's side, before she was born, her family was also in hospitality too. But you know, I was born in Miami, and my parents are immigrants from Hong Kong. And my dad, you know, worked in restaurants as an employee, as a busboy when he was younger in New York City, waited tables on Long Island, actually. You know, that was his night and weekend job. But during the day, he worked in a commercial laundry business. And this is a long, circuitous route because the restaurant business is one of those industries where you can kind of come with little experience. You grind, you work hard, you're patient, you're humble. Dad asked to come in early so he could learn how to cook so that he could learn more about the business. You know, by the time we got to Miami, Dad had a failed business, then finally had one that worked really well, Canton. And that's really my entry into the business, where I worked nights and weekends at a Chinese American restaurant. Probably every city in North America has one of these, where, you know, you had a husband in the back in the kitchen, a wife in the front. And that's where I grew up. But Dad was a fabulous restaurateur.
You know, it is interesting to think that the restaurant space is honestly one of the last bastions of being able to like get in at the ground floor and really work your way up. And it's really cool because if you have the interest and you put in the time and effort, like you said, you know, you can, you know, work your way up to the point of operating your own restaurant. And that also kind of transitions a little bit into your collegiate experience going to study hospitality. So what was kind of the thought process there?
So, you know, mom and dad always push, as all immigrants do, that their kids, you know, study hard and do well in school. You know, the school that I went to, Cornell, I was in the hospitality school there in Ithaca, New York. And I always loved, you know, so much about the business, the teamwork, the creativity, you know, creating a sense of place. I always loved brands. And Cornell was an amazing place, amazing professors, quintessential college experience. I did internships during my summers in the hotel business, in the restaurant business. And, you know, it was just an incredible foundation. Dad, you know, really, you know, wanted me to get the best education I could. So I had a super fancy education at Cornell. But my dad, you know, he never finished high school in China, you know, or Hong Kong when he came over. So he was a middle school graduate, but he always, as well as mom, knew that education was an escape out. So so I went to Cornell, and my first job out of Cornell was with Ernst & Young as a financial analyst. And I did that for a few years. But, you know, happy to talk about my college experience. My headspace is kind of there right now because my son's in college and my daughter.
That's exciting.
My daughter starts Cornell next month in August.
Are they following suit with the hotel administration program?
Well, my daughter is. Lindsay's awesome. Going to the hotel school, and my son is studying English literature. So he's probably going to go, you know, kind of the law school route. So I've got one in it and one probably not.
Yeah. Well, who knows? Maybe you, maybe he could help with like menu copy or something like that.
Exactly.
Awesome. I'm curious, Abe, this show is called Handling the Heat, and it's about how people, you know, get in, fail quick, figure out what works and what doesn't, and move forward. And I know your initial kind of entrepreneurial, separate apart from your familial restaurant, you know, step through that kind of journey was Rapido down back in Miami. So can you talk a little bit about the transition away from the more stable Ernst & Young financial analyst experience into that?
Yeah. So always a fun kind of, you know, period. I was at Ernst & Young when I was at, you know, college. I always loved reading the trade press, you know, Night Dishes, Restaurant News. And back in the late 90s, these things called wraps were exploding in California and in Washington State. So, you know, pick a food trend today, you know, matcha or fast casual pizza from a few years ago, or, you know, kind of fast casual Mediterranean today. It was wraps back then. So, you know, we really thought that Miami could learn to love wraps, much like what was going on in the Bay Area and all over California. And one of my cube mates and I, you know, both had that itch to start something. So we wrote a business plan. We raised some money from friends and family. My parents and my family were initial investors too. And we were off to the races and opened up a concept called Rapido. Opened up one location, then a second. My dad was not just an investor, but he was an operating partner too. So we had a lot of support, and it was so fun. We, you know, were really celebrated by the local press. Young guys, kind of learning these cool things called wraps, or introducing them to South Florida. Had another operating partner, a high school buddy of mine named Surf, along with my other founding partner, Jason Silverman. And we opened up two locations in quick succession. But, you know, down the road, we realized that these concepts, you know, did really strong lunch day parts, and dinners were a little bit soft. So, you know, we worked, we grinded. Jason realized that the business wasn't for him in the long run. And, you know, we went our separate ways. And, you know, anytime there's a business kind of separation, it's tough. It's emotional. It was, you know, he had investors, family, as I did. But, you know, like what I can tell you is that over the years we've rekindled our friendship, and you know, we talk often, we see each other. But starting a business with a co-founder when you're young is super, you know, kind of fertile ground for conflict. So, but you know, my other partners and I, we argued, and at the end of the day, we learned that the rap business just didn't have legs, and it just wasn't us. It was everybody. There were rap concerts. Funny enough, one called Rapido in Austin, Texas, too, that also didn't make it. And interestingly, the founder there, I've met him, and he too converted, you know, his concepts to different concepts too. So, anyways, what was going on is we thought that sushi had some legs. We introduced a little bit of sushi at Rapido, and then there's a further and better story about how we came up with the concept.
Yeah, so I feel like though it's interesting because when you, especially as you know, mid 20s, late 20s. Entrepreneur, you kind of have to have a screw loose to do something that doesn't work and just double down on something that may work.
It comes down to having kind of support, you know, from family and friends. You know, my dad had that immigrant work mentality of like, you don't give up, you know, he that wasn't an option. My wife came from an entrepreneurial family. You know, her dad did multiple businesses. And also, you know, she understood and always supported me being in the restaurants, nights, weekends. We had a very different life than a typical young couple that, you know, would be able to go out on nights and weekends. And that wasn't us when we were, you know, newly married. And the other part of the story is that my wife, we dated long distance for the first few years of Rapido, where I could really lock in and I was flexible enough to go visit her, and she came to visit me mostly. My family, you know, welcomed her staying in my parents' home. We had just so much support. And early on, when we were really deciding, do we want to make a continued go of this? My wife at that point already was making a good salary as a litigator at a law firm. So I think, you know, to me, the stories of an entrepreneur, you need kind of a life partner, a significant other, a wife, a spouse that really supports you, because there's a lot of rocky road ahead. It's white water if you're kind of using that kind of rafting analogy. So we experienced all of it. There were times certainly when we wanted to give up, but you know, I had people in my life, my sister, my wife, my parents that just said, let's keep tinkering with it and maybe we'll figure it out.
No, that's great. And I think, you know, people give a lot of credit to the entrepreneur, and it's really the, you know, silent majority of the people around them that really enable the double down, triple down, make sure that whatever you're doing is what you should be doing ultimately.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
until it sticks. So that's right. A great story.
That's right. So, you know, we it wasn't like when we opened the doors of our secondary concept that we're busy, you know, we were kind of tinkering with it. It was a very modest neighborhood sushi bar that just kind of delivered on a fantastic experience, trying to give value to people. There was fancy sushi in Miami at Nobu and Zuma. So, you know, expensive executive accounts could afford it. But every day, how could people get a premium experience at an affordable rate? And kind of the business school terms that we use, we wanted to demystify and democratize sushi. And a lot of that, you know, we did. The names we chose, the descriptions, we just wanted to make sushi super approachable.
Yeah. And I think that is really interesting, especially because back in, you know, 2000, when you started Sushi Maki, it was likely very unapproachable, especially with the Nobus of the world, the Zumas of the world. And the fact that people didn't really have the palette for it potentially in the broader, you know, American consumer base. What was the niche that you thought would have changed that? Is it just like how it's described on the menu? Is it like the way it's prepared?
So I think it's the identity of it. I think we, from day one, you know, we wanted to make it a place where you can go multiple times a week. And I think there was that fancy sushi where it was a special occasion, but we thought there was a world where people could, you know, enjoy it a couple of times a week. And I think, you know, people don't consider sushi to be Japanese food today. And the analogy that I sometimes make is, you know, pizza, Italian roots, but I think people don't consider pizza to be Italian food. They consider it food. And I think there's sushi everywhere. And I don't think people necessarily consider it Japanese. Maybe they consider it an Asian food, but for sure, you see sushi at all sorts of restaurants. And probably in South Florida, our biggest competitors aren't so much other neighborhood sushi bars. They aren't the fancy kind of places that are charging, you know, the $200 omakase. Is that, like, you know, you have Peruvian restaurants that have ceviche and they have sushi on their menu. Excellent sushi, you know. You've got Hillstone Bar, American Bar and Grill, that has an amazing sushi bar, you know, next to. So we just have so many different competitors on the restaurant side of the equation.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And I guess the democratization that you spearheaded has enabled those other competitors to really open up their menu to something like this.
Sure. I think we're part of the conversation. It's happening with or without us, but I think right place, right time. And I do think where we really went in deep to providing lots of sushi was our opening of Sushi Maki at the universities down here, U of M, FIU, which is like the University of Florida at Miami. There are some other universities in Fort Lauderdale and in Palm Beach County that we have locations, FAU and Nova. So we have those installations. Probably our most kind of acclaimed partnership is the one we have with Whole Foods Market. We're at 15 different Whole Foods here in the Tri-County area in Southeast Florida. So that, I think, once we started doing, you know, business with them, that really gave us kind of a tremendous reach and like an incredible billboard, having our sushi at Whole Foods Market. And when we did it from day one, we always wanted to have our brands be front and center. We weren't, you know, we didn't want to be hired out.
No, that's huge. And it just adds to, you know, the ethos that is Sushi Maki. But let's take it back a little bit, because you don't just go from one or two Sushi Makis to being in 15 Whole Foods. Yes. I want to talk a little bit about that journey. And I think part of it is, you know, the approachability potentially of the brand, but part of it is the operational excellence that you have to have and the consistency that you have to have, especially if people are coming two or three times a week, like you said.
Yeah.
What were the non-negotiables of your Sushi Maki operational experience?
So there's two parts of the business. One is the Whole Foods partnership, and the other one is wholesale sushi, where we sell ready-to-eat sushi at all the luxury hotels in South Florida, the Ritz-Carltons, the Four Seasons. Oftentimes, that's just white label. It's a B2B. And how we got that business, people ask, is we asked for it. When I was working in the restaurants, we had high quality and we had executive chefs that on their day off at the Westin would come to our restaurant and appreciate the quality and the value that we offered. And, you know, when you're working the restaurant, you ask people what they do, and we got to a conversation. He's an executive chef. He buys sushi typically from, you know, another restaurant. I said, give us a chance. And we made sure that we delivered excellence. And I also professionalized a very fragmented industry. We created professional invoices. We delivered, you know, packaging on ice. We just did all the little things to professionalize that industry. And that business is the most profitable part of our business. It's highly seasonal in Florida. You know, you're basically going from Thanksgiving-ish to Mother's Day. So you have like 6 months to do business. There's nothing, you know, going on in the summertime in terms of events. But that's a part of the business that I think just required you to be in the restaurant, ask for the business, get to know people. The other thing that people ask is, how did we end up at the universities and at Whole Foods? And that's also, you know, coming up with an idea and going after it, because these buyers are notorious for being pursued by many. And the buyer at Whole Foods, you know, I basically approached and was relentless for about 3 years, asking her, you know, to give us a shot to be in a Whole Foods. And finally, she, you know, grew tired of me asking and gave us a shot. And we were off to the races with our first Whole Foods market in Coral Gables, Florida. And, you know, one store led to another. First one was in 2008. Here we are, you know, several years later with many more stores. And I think people, you know, did believe in our thesis of providing restaurant quality sushi and hospitality in a supermarket. Whole Foods just has terrific prepared foods. Wegmans, kind of in your neck of the woods, you know, is a model for providing outstanding food. And, you know, when you're joining the dots about saying you can do this, you know, here, you know, that's when, as an entrepreneur, you're trying to sell the dream of delivering better, you know, and solving a problem that they may not even know they have.
Yeah. I think what's interesting about sushi in particular is, for me at least, it comes down to the freshness of the preparation of the fish, right? Like, you could have the best sushi chef imaginable, these like top echelon sushi chefs, and if they're picking up scraps from, you know, behind the fishmonger, it's a totally different product. And I think it's because of its simplicity generally, it really makes it much more difficult to provide that high level of product, especially if you're going to Whole Foods and they're sitting on shelves, and especially if you're going B2B to these hotels. How do you ensure that, obviously with your restaurants, it feels like it would be an easier, you know, chef to table experience. It's a shorter window. How do you make sure you provide that same level of freshness and that same quality of product when you're shipping to Whole Foods and to these hotels?
Yeah. So with Whole Foods, we actually make the sushi at the market. It's our team members. It's our cost of goods sold. And it's a partnership. It's a revenue share. For hotels, you know, it's all about kind of the quality standards and basically relying on recipes and brands that we respect and admire, and making sure that it's of a quality that's consistent. And with sushi, the rice is actually very formula driven. And if you have that relentless repeatability of having the same rice maker that is making it and not cutting corners, that's why in Japan, right, these guys are washing rice and for years, you know, it's there is mastery to that craft. And what we do is we do it at scale. When you have experience, the rice maker also knows that when there's higher humidity, you know, you reduce the amount of water that is making the rice. It's not unlike bakers, that it's art, right? It's not just science. You have recipes for different times of years. You talk to master pasta makers and pizza and bagel, craftsmen. It does require experience. I myself am not a sushi chef, but, you know, well, I've eaten and tasted enough rice to kind of really appreciate the nuance of it. When it comes to the fish, you know, what you want to do is you want to buy in quantities, and you want to have a busy pipeline so that you're turning that fish, that salmon, that tuna, that crab stick, because, you know, when you're eating something raw in that very kind of exposed and naked state, there's nowhere to hide. You know, you have to have quality ingredients at the right, you know, time that it's made. It's made today at 3 p.m. It's going to be enjoyed tonight at 7. And I tell people that our wholesale business is a logistics business, right? It's, we make the sushi 24 hours around the clock, depending on when the event is. We deliver it with our own team members. We can't outsource that. You know, we have to have really tight windows about when we make the sushi to when it goes onto the Mother's Day buffet at, you know, the JW Marriott. So, you know, we take a lot of pride in that. We've been doing this for almost 20 years. The brand's been around for 25 years, but we've been doing a high quality, high scale business in wholesale for 20 years now.
That's amazing. And the logistics business is a super apt representation of what it sounds like you're doing. And at every step of the way, if it doesn't hit exactly where it needs to hit, the whole thing falls apart. How do you, and I know you've invested a lot in technology. I know it's very technically enabled, the process. Is there a secret sauce that you could say has enabled that success? Or is it just the same amount of hard work that, you know, the sushi chef that's cleaning rice in Japan needs to go through over and over and over again?
We all kind of learn from each other. And I, you know, was inspired by a wholesale sushi company in Las Vegas. I met another one in Hawaii. And, you know, so the equipment I use, the process, I learned from others through observation, asking questions. You know, if you're humble, you ask questions and you're transparent, people will help you. This business is definitely hard to scale in terms of the wholesale business. So I've learned a lot from people that are very generous, you know, with their time. And then the other part of it is just kind of trial and error. You make a lot of mistakes. At Miami, is continually to grow as a city. So the logistics are getting more and more complicated in terms of the amount of time it takes to get from one part of town to the other. I tell people Miami's a lot like Los Angeles now, where once you're nestled in certain neighborhoods, you don't cross town as much. Because, you know, we do what we do, we have to understand that and get the sushi to where it needs to get to, both at our Whole Foods, our universities, our own restaurants, and certainly our wholesale clients. So, you know, the job has changed. You're constantly changing your mindset from being kind of artisans with the food, trying to, you know, become, you know, thoughtful industrial engineers with production and logistical experts and getting, you know, the product from point A to point B. So you need a team that is fully integrated, but also has some deep expertise in some certain functional areas. And that's part of the business that's really changed, where, you know, it goes from, you know, founders and entrepreneurs that wear multiple hats to orchestrating, finding, retaining, and leading a team that has different functional expertise.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, finding those people and cultivating them and making sure that they can execute to the same you know, level that you yourself hold yourself to is, I think, you know, critical. Yeah. for that kind of growth. Where do you think, Abe, the further growth happens for Sushi Maki? Where next, now that you've, yeah, you know, been in all these different places and have had the success?
You know, because South Florida is growing so fast that there continues to be more kind of dense growth in Whole Foods, for example. I think there's 4 more Whole Foods opening up in this submarket within the next 18 months. And that's not the same, you know, across all markets. It's just the population boom. This was happening. This was accelerated by COVID. There's folks from, you know, your neck of the woods that always have come down. But what's new is the Midwest, the Chicago, the St. Louis. What's very new is people moving from California to South Florida. You know, and I think that, you know, Sushi Maki continues to have lots of opportunity for growth here. I think, you know, what else is ahead for Sushi Maki is, you know, all of our partners, our universities are adding additional capacities and campuses. You know, Vanderbilt's opening up a campus here in Palm Beach County. So we just think that we're super blessed to be in a market that's growing. That's also not to say we don't consider looking at airports, you know, in cities outside of Florida. So we've got a team that's exploring what does Sushi Maki look like if we were to partner with other operators and license. You know, one part of our company that we're super proud of and probably is, you know, along with Whole Foods, what we're best known for is our multiple installations at Miami International Airport. In various locations before and after security. You know, we love that business. Maybe there's an area where Miami brand Sushimaki can thrive outside. I think what's kind of cool about my city now is we've always imported brands from Europe or from New York. But, you know, just being in the city, I don't know if you've experienced Pura Vida. There's Skinny Louie's. There's a burger chain. There's Motec, which is a full service Mediterranean. There's Q, which is a fantastic Asian concept. You know, for being a Miami guy, we are so proud and thrilled to see kind of Miami restaurant brands kind of opening up on the biggest stage, right, on the planet, right, New York City. So so I don't see that for Sushimaki. I think there's wonderful sushi in New York, but I do think maybe there's room for Sushimaki in other airports. So, you know, that's stuff that we're dreaming with our team. But we have enough kind of growth that's in the pipeline here to certainly keep us focused and excited.
No, definitely. And that's super exciting. And I'm actually, my space is right in between the Q and the two Pura Vidas that just opened downtown Manhattan. So
what do you think about that?
I think it's great. I think the smoothies are really good. Pura Vida, they're a little bit on the pricier side, but they're hefty. You know, you go for breakfast good till lunch. So,
you know, it's like I'm amazed, right, and admire like how beautiful their stores are, how busy they are.
It's a slice of Miami right when you walk in every time.
Yeah, but it's unbelievable how much they charge.
And I and it's still packed. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Still packed. It's funny that you as a New Yorker are saying that too, but we in Miami say that too. And, you know, my kids and their friends, my kids and their friends can't get enough of Pura Venus. It's a wonderful, you know, case study. I think they're opening, you know, a Skinny Louie's kind of smash burger concept that you need to check out and tell me what you think about that.
I will for sure. Cool. Well, Abe, I have one final question. I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't ask this, which is what's your favorite maki roll?
Wow. So my favorite roll is it's called the Budokan. It's a little bit indulgent. If I'm trying to do the everyday clean roll, I'm pretty simple. We call it a university salmon and avocado for the University of Miami. We call it the U roll for the University of Miami. But so that's my everyday go-to roll. But If I'm feeling a little bit more indulgent, I want something, that's hits some different notes. It's called the Budokan, which is a shrimp tempura roll with avocado and mango, thinly sliced on top, with some nice dollops of spicy mayonnaise. So you hit the cream, the sweetness, you've got the crunch, and then there's a drizzle of the sweetened soy or the eel sauce. So,
delicious.
I can eat that every day, and really, that's one of the things that I'm super, you know, blessed with. Like sushi, you can eat it multiple times a week, and it still works. So, but
totally agree. I might have to get some now after this for dinner. But awesome, yeah. Abe, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate you talking about your story, and really excited. To
I love it, Zach. I love what you're doing. You know, I know you're innovating, you know, within the platform that, you know, that you've stepped into. And I just want to encourage you that, you know, the best ideas are always going to be, you know, the ones that are coming from the next generation. And I know how much, you know, you do to help the industry. And if you could do it more efficiently, there's more companies like ours that you guys can help. I know your dad has helped me a lot personally, you know, with things of the business, but more importantly, you know, kind of thinking about the business looking forward. So if there's ever anything I can do to serve the Sherman clan, please let me know.
Awesome. I appreciate that. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks.